Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. My guest on this podcast today is Sir Jeremy Farrar, who is the chief scientist at the World Health Organization and was previously director of the Wellcome Trust. Jeremy, welcome to this podcast.
Andy, thanks very much. It's a huge pleasure and honour to join you.
So, Jeremy, you are the chief scientist at the World Health Organization. You've been in that role since earlier this year. Tell us a little bit about what does the chief scientist do at the World Health Organization?
That's a good question. So I've been here not quite 6 months now. I arrived as spring was arriving in Geneva, and I'm here now as the first snowfall on the hills around us comes. Firstly, I'd pay tribute to my predecessor, Sumir Somanathan, has, I think, played an absolutely critical role as chief scientist here during COVID. And she was the first chief scientist at the World Health Organization, I think, for many, many years, took on the role 2019 or so. And then, of course, within 6 months, COVID hit. So in essence, I think in many ways, the role of chief scientist within the World Health Organization, but actually true across UN agencies, perhaps still needs to be defined. How can we bring real added value to a lot of technical divisions and departments within WHO and within sister agencies of the UN system, ensuring that science is the heart of everything we do, evidence, and then how do we work best with our external partners? So I think it is broad ranging, probably still to be defined to some degree.
So, Jeremy, my reading suggests that you were born in Singapore and then had a fairly nomadic childhood. So how did that set you up for thinking about your career going forward? Where did you spend your time during your childhood?
So, yeah, I was born in Singapore, and then we had an iterant life. I'm the youngest of six children in the family, and we lived in Singapore and we lived in Cyprus for a while. We emigrated to New Zealand. That's my first memory, actually, but I'm afraid, and it's no disrespect or dislike of New Zealand at all, but after 6 months, particularly my mother decided that New Zealand in the late 1960s wasn't for us. So I came to the UK for the first time ever by boat from New Zealand in the late 1960s. And then we moved to Tripoli, Libya for 7 years during my teenage life, and then went back to the UK and studied medicine. I'm not sure what influence it has on you. It certainly has an influence. I think, of course, the living in multiple different cultures obviously has a long-term influence on you. The years in Libya, for instance, which is a tragedy of what's happened to the country recently, but it's an absolutely beautiful country, and living in that environment for 7 years had a big impact on me. I think also the ability to work across people from different backgrounds, I'm sure that must have some influence. But also, you know, I always used to look wistfully at people that had deep friendships and knowledge of an environment, were born, let's say, in the UK or anywhere else, but had a deep sort of sense of belonging to that culture, which I perhaps miss in some ways. So, it has positives and negatives. I mean, you try and cover up the negatives and accentuate the positives.
And you said you went to study medicine at UCL. And I was trying to think of whether there was some connection to infectious disease. You spent so much of your life working in it. And I understand you did do a BSc degree in immunology, but I suspect that was directing you towards the autoimmune diseases of the brain rather than to infectious diseases.
Yeah, again, when I was doing that degree, and you know, it's always, I think, important to pay tribute to people that have had an influence on life. I worked during that project in the BSc at UCL and what was then called the Middlesex Hospital with somebody called Professor Cheryl Tickle, who was a cell biologist working on chick limb bud development and the impact of vitamin A retinoic acid. At that stage, as a whatever I was, 20, whatever it would be, 22, I suppose, that sort of age, I had no inkling what I wanted to do later, to be honest. What Cheryl, though, taught me, which you miss, I think, in medical school, I hope we haven't lost it altogether, and that is medical school, there is an enormous number of facts to be learned. There's perhaps less than there could and should be of questioning those facts and a sort of scientific method. And Cheryl, for the first time, taught me the excitement of working at the boundaries of knowledge and the uncertainty that comes with that, something I'd not really experienced, to be honest, in the first 2 years when I was getting through neuroanatomy and physiology and anatomy, where I just had to learn what was done and I had to somehow replicate that in an essay or answer a whole pile of multiple choice questions. But Cheryl really showed there was real excitement in not knowing something and trying to work out what it did. It didn't sort of matter.
You trained in neurology and you were doing a PhD, which you finished in the late 90s in Oxford, on an immune disorder called myasthenia gravis. So how did that PhD project, how did that lead you to infectious diseases and the work that you've done since?
It didn't. I mean, that's a... It didn't, other than through luck. The PhD was a struggle. It wasn't natural to go from clinical work in Edinburgh, working particularly, and then in Melbourne, actually, working on stroke with Charles Warlow and somebody called Jeff Donnan in Melbourne. But the background in immunology had always interested me, thinking that it would play a much bigger role than it, even at the time it was thought, across different areas in medicine and public health in the future. And the opportunity came from when in Edinburgh to meet the group in Oxford at the now called Wetherall Institute of Molecular Medicine. And, you know, as a young, ambitious clinical clinician wanting to do a PhD, it was just an incredible opportunity to work with a brilliant individual, brilliant clinical scientist who died far too young, I'm afraid, in a car accident, John Newsome Davis and Angela Vincent in Oxford and Wilcox. It was an amazing group. I struggled during the PhD, and I think one of the lessons from that is how to deal with adversity. I found it difficult going from being a clinician to working exclusively in the laboratory. I think we don't acknowledge challenge in our careers when we have some really dark and difficult moments, but we somehow need to get through it. We can only get through it with good mentorship and support.
So around that time, as you were finishing that, you moved to Vietnam. How did that position come apart? That was to lead the Wellcome Trust unit in Vietnam.
So here I pay tribute to the Institute of Molecular Medicine, because one of the wonderful features of that institute, certainly when I joined, was a coffee room and lunch room in the middle of the building. Those who are listening to this know the Institute, Wetherall Institute of Molecular Medicine, will remember that. And why that is so important is it's a place where chance meetings happen and you're not so stuck behind a closed room in a closed lab, but you can interact with lots of other people. It was one of the great attributes of, and I hope we never lose that coffee room mixture of people from different disciplines working together. And here I paid a tribute to somebody called Dave Roberts, who's still working as a hematologist in Oxford. And by chance, over a lunch or coffee or I don't know what, as I was coming to the end of the PhD, Dave said, you know, did you know this role is coming up in Vietnam? Because somebody called Nick Day, had been there for a long time, 4 or 5 years, was leaving. And, you know, Dave knew my background in Asia and he knew that perhaps I didn't want to necessarily go forward with a career in neurology, and said they were looking for somebody with a more scientific and immunological background for the future. And why didn't I have a look at it? I mean, it was as simple as that. And I applied and somehow managed, was then appointed and moved to Vietnam in sort of the end of 1995, in the first quarter of 1996.
And in that experience, you had your first experiences of major outbreaks of new diseases. What happened there?
Well, the first time actually I was involved in it, was indirectly involved, was in, but I often go back to it because I think so many lessons were learnt and many lessons were not learnt. And that was with an outbreak of something called Nipah virus in Malaysia in 1999. This was subsequently shown to be caused by Nipah virus, linked with bats and to pig farming in Malaysia. And it had everything that subsequent epidemics and indeed pandemics have had. It was a novel virus. It had profound societal, cultural, indeed religious connotations, because pig farming was in one part of the Malaysian community and much of the authorities were from a different cultural background, etc. And so that led to issues. The causative agent was not identified to begin with, and perhaps it was thought to be Japanese encephalitis, and public health measures were instituted. And then eventually, having caused a number of deaths and a devastation of an industry, finally it did come to an end. But of course, Nipah virus has become endemic now in Bangladesh and remains a threat. But to me, that was the start. And then, of course, in Vietnam, we had SARS-1, then H5N1 outbreak, which was very worrying and very concerning to be part of, and very frightening, actually.
So SARS-1 was a coronavirus about 20 years ago, but then H5, that would have been around 2004, five, something like that?
Yeah, they were within a year of each other, really. And in fact, when H5N1 came about 6 months after the end of SARS-1, the first coronavirus really causing a major problem. 6 months later, we had patients coming into the hospital with what looked like a very similar syndrome, a severe pneumonia, very tragic high mortality rate. And actually, our first thought was, is this a return of the SARS coronavirus that had caused, 8,000 or so cases and I think 800 or 900 deaths around the world? And in fact, it was overnight on the eve of Vietnamese Tet. And Vietnamese Tet, for those who don't know, it is Vietnamese New Year, also aligns with the Chinese New Year in end of January every year. And it is like Thanksgiving and Christmas and Eid and everything thrown into one. It's a wonderful time of year, but everybody's away on holiday. And as always happens, epidemics and crises happen when they almost invariably happen at weekends or on holiday times. And it was a very frightening time because you don't know what you're dealing with. You have a severe pneumonia, a number of patients coming in. Are you at risk? Are the nurses at risk? Are the doctors at risk? You've no idea what the cause is. And I have to say my recollection of that time was both huge fear and chaos, but also a very strong commitment by professionals, nurses, doctors, scientists, to get to the bottom of it as quickly as possible and identify the cause, alert the world, and then start thinking how best to deal with it.
And we should say that H5 is an influenza virus.
We know when it comes across into humans, it has a high mortality. And I think the world is at grave risk of H5N1, an animal virus, poultry virus, an avian bird virus, jumping across to humans and causing a problem. And we don't know if it'll happen tomorrow or never, but we're perhaps not as well prepared as we should be for what is now a pandemic in birds and mammals.
Yes, and this bird influenza virus doesn't need very many mutations to become transmissible in humans, and that's why it remains right at the top of the risk register for governments.
Exactly. In fact, I think we may need a new approach to this. I mean, my view of this is the greatest risk to humanity is of what's called non-human influenza virus coming across the species barrier from birds or poultry or mammals into humans, to which humanity has no immunity. And actually, I think we should be systematically developing, with a platform technology, vaccines against all the non-human influenza strains through to, let's say, phase 1 and phase 2 studies, so that we know they're safe, we know they're immunogenic, and we could produce them at scale if there was a terrible pandemic of influenza with a non-human influenza viruses. And we also have to think the monitoring and the surveillance, I think, is much better than it used to be. But we're well short as well on the therapeutic side. We don't have enough drugs to deal with a very nasty influenza.
So you learnt a huge amount through those years in Vietnam, as you mentioned, with the Nipah virus outbreak, following on with the first coronavirus outbreak, SARS-CoV-1, I guess we would call it now, and H5 influenza. But then just around 10 years ago, you left Vietnam and became director of the Wellcome Trust. So what was your thinking behind that major career move, and what do you think your major achievements from those 10 years?
Again, not planned, because we had decided actually that we would remain in Asia for, you know, many years until, well, who knows, until retirement or something. But we have 3 children, and they were by then at school, for secondary school in Singapore, and I was commuting between Ho Chi Minh City and Singapore. It's only an hour's flight, so it's relatively easy to do. So that was our plan. And when the first thinking around the search for the new director of Wellcome came up, in fact, very early on were approached, but had then decided to stay. And then, for whatever reasons, Wellcome couldn't find the right person. And then we started to have a conversation much later, and then moved in October of 2013. That's right. So almost exactly 10 years ago now. So obviously, I've known Wellcome for many years. I think it is a remarkable organization. It's 70 or 80 years old now, set up by somebody called Henry Wellcome in the 1930s. Henry Wellcome was an American, but became based in the UK, and then became the Wellcome Trust. And it grew to a remarkable size. And in 2013, you could see that it was going to continue to grow for some considerable time and become increasingly important.
Important as one of the major biomedical science funders that there is anywhere in the world.
That's right. And a unique in a sense, unique is a big word, but unique in a sense because Wellcome Trust is completely independent of government. It's a charity. It's completely independent of any industrial link or commercial link. It is independent of any living donor. There were no family members of Henry Wellcome to continue to be involved. So it's one of those rare examples of a very large, I think about $45 to $50 billion endowment now, and able to fund, I think, about $2 billion a year of funding for science, and is completely independent with its own governance structure. That's relatively, or maybe even unique, actually. And I think that brings a huge responsibility. And when I joined, I think there were two questions really in my mind, and indeed at the mind of the board at the time. Number one is, how do you deal with growth? I mean, that sounds a silly thing, because growth should be a hugely positive thing. But growth needs thinking about. You can't just grow. When you become twice the size as an organization as you were before, or actually even bigger, three or four times the size, you're a fundamentally different organization, different responsibility. So how do you deal with growth? How do you make sure your governance structures are right? Your ability to give away that amount of money needs thinking about, rather than just sort of falling in it and reacting to it. And then the perennial question, which I appreciate is controversial, and not everybody would agree with the direction we took it in, but the question of whether Wellcome Trust is there to support UK science, and through that to do good and to improve health around the world, or it's there to improve health through research and is in the UK because the UK is a great place to do science, but is open to the world. And I think that that's a challenge. We moved more towards the Wellcome Trust was based in the UK, but had a global reach, and the UK remains a great place to do science, as we all know. But I think that is a perennial debate for Wellcome, and I appreciate not everybody would agree with the direction we took it in. But I, at the scale it then grew to, I very strongly felt it had a responsibility to the world to use the best science, wherever it was, to make an impact on health globally. That was my view, and it was backed by the board, but I appreciate, Andy, there'll be others that had a different perspective on that.
And one of the things that under your tenure Wellcome did was put some of those funds into pandemic research, largely via the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, which was all happening just before the arrival of SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus. When did you first become aware that this new virus was going to cause problems?
Well, I think it goes back to those conversations about Nipah and SARS-CoV-1, as you say, we call it now, and bird flu, and an appreciation that epidemics and pandemics were now going to be part of the world every year in reality. Because in my view, the epidemics and pandemics we face are symptoms of underlying drivers, which are very much defining the 21st century. So biodiversity loss, environment change, climate change, in changing interactions between humans and animals, bearing in mind that almost all infectious diseases and pandemics come from animals and into humans, urbanization, trade and travel. So those are the key drivers. And the SARS-CoV-1 and 2 and Nipah and others, Zika, these Ebola, these are the symptoms, the outcomes of those big underpinning drivers. So we're living in an era of pandemics. And yet for pandemics, which may never happen, we may never have an H5N1 human epidemic, there are no commercial drivers. Why would you produce drugs, diagnostics, and vaccines when something may never happen? And there's no commercial imperative to do that. And so there was an absolutely critical need for the public sector, government, and philanthropy to join together and with industry and say, this is too big a risk to the world. We need to invest in the science, the basic science and the applied science, to make sure that the world is less vulnerable. And that came together around the Coalition of Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, CEPI, to try and work through initially vaccines. I had hoped also therapeutics, to make sure that this market failure, in a sense, could be dealt with through public and philanthropic and industrial links.
And then as you get to 2019, when certainly in China, the first cases of this new coronavirus were occurring, had you already heard about it in December of 2019, or like most of us, was it not until 2020 that you became aware?
So I first became aware with a text message from the then director of China CDC, who was an old friend, George Gao, when I was returning from Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo, because I'd been there in my Wellcome role, looking at the Ebola vaccine studies that were going on as primary prevention and Ebola vaccines in the community. And I was flying back to London on the 31st of December when I got a text from George Gao to say that there was an outbreak of pneumonia in a city I'd not heard of at that time, Wuhan, and that they were working on it and the rest of it. So that was the first I heard of it, and then spent much of January, of course, as with everybody else, coming to grips with it, of what it really meant, with regular phone calls with clinicians in Wuhan and with colleagues in Oxford at that time, Peter Horby as well, trying to understand what was going to happen with this, at that time on the 31st of December, undiagnosed but clearly severe pneumonia in patients in Wuhan.
And so the Wellcome Trust was involved in funding some of the work that was done. But you also had other roles, as you say, in convening and talking with scientists. But I think critically also, you were very involved in advice to government during that period. Was that an established role that you already had as Director of Wellcome Trust and advising government? Or were you brought into a government advisory committee, which is called SAGE, as because of the outbreak that was happening?
So I was involved prior to 2019-20 with various advisory roles linked with UK government. There's a group that comes together with all the life science funders from UKRI, UK Research and Innovation, which includes the Medical Research Council, but also the Department of Health and Social Care and many others. And that's a standing group that comes together, I think, very constructively on a regular basis to discuss the life science sector within the UK and health research and a number of others. But SAGE itself, the Scientific Advisory Group on Emergencies, is an ad hoc group. It's not, as far as I'm aware, a standing group. It comes together to deal with whatever the emergency is, whether it be volcanoes erupting or it's a pandemic or an epidemic. So it's created and comes under the chief scientist at that time, Sir Patrick Vallance, and Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer. And it comes into place when there is an emergency with people that are thought to have the skills that can contribute to that discussion. And I suppose I was brought on, yes, as head of Wellcome, but also because of A, the background in Asia in emerging infections, and also the roles in things like CEPI and the international links I had through my time in Vietnam and particularly with Asia.
And so during that period, during 2020, when there was so much going on, whether it was in managing hospitals full of patients with the COVID-19 or the vaccine development or drug development, what were you spending your time doing every day? Were you there working mostly with government on policy, or what was the way you spent your time?
Yeah, I mean, for everybody, including yourself and all your colleagues who developed the vaccine in Oxford, a remarkable story. I mean, looking back on it now and listening through to some of the issues around the public inquiry that's now going on and contributing to, yeah, I don't think any of us have been through something like that in such an intense way over such a long period of time, and dealing both with issues in our personal lives, dealing with the pandemic, which is enough, and huge horror stories there for many families, and then also dealing with the professional aspect. And I think it strained everybody beyond what any of us had been used to before. And there was also the continued role as Director of Wellcome, and that job didn't go away during all of this time as well. So it was, as with you, Andy, there was multiple hats to wear. There's a lot of expertise in the SAGE group, from clinicians, epidemiologists, mathematical modelers, people understanding behavioral science. I mean, there's hundreds of people involved in the SAGE process. I think perhaps my biggest contribution would be to be one step removed from that, and having experienced epidemics before and the way Asia dealt with them, whether in China with SARS-1 or Vietnam with bird flu or whatever, and that international network that I had meant perhaps I had insights coming from, for instance, friends and colleagues in Italy at the start of what happened in Lombardy in northern Italy and in an intensive care unit in February of 2020, and bringing some of that voice to bear on the discussions. I would pay tribute here. You know, SAGE has had a lot of criticism and some of it justified, but I absolutely pay tribute here to the way that Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty chaired that group. I think they were totally honourable to the science. They represented it strongly within government. And I have nothing but respect for the way they handled that process.
Yes, very difficult, as you say, to draw together the very many different scientific themes. Now, of course, most of us as scientists live in silos of expertise, but really important to try and bring that together to provide policy advice, which often has to take some opposing views together. And certainly my reflection would be that, as you say, Patra Vallance and Chris Whitty did that extremely well. So your role during that also included quite a high public profile and a lot of communication through the media. Is that something that you had planned to do, or you felt was an important part of the role in Wellcome?
Yeah, again, certainly not planned to do. I mean, prior to 2019, you know, independent of the pandemic, the Wellcome role, as with all my predecessors, Mark Wolpert and others, and I'm sure what should remain in the future, it is crucial that the Wellcome Trust is open to the public and to, you know, radical transparency, if a phrase that was used internally, and that has a media role. I think it is crucial that all of us play a role in the public discourse. I think building public trust in science is crucial, and maintaining it is even more important. And I think you have to do that by being a public face, whether it comes naturally to you or not. But yes, then through 2020 to 2023, really, I think it was important for people to make themselves available to the media. Here, I would praise the Science Media Centre in the UK. It is a place that journalists can go, and indeed the public, and listen to, challenge, question the scientific community about what they're doing. And I think Fiona Fox, who runs the Science Media Centre, has done a fantastic job. And I've often argued that every country should have a science media centre to allow people to quiz and challenge and question scientists. And I think that is the only way to build trust. But it was a very difficult time. I mean, I'm not pretending for any second that my time was any harder than anybody else's, either people involved directly in policy and science or the public dealing with the pandemic. We all had a horrific time during that time. But yeah, it was a difficult time. And getting the right balance between communicating as an independent scientist serving on stage, you must remember that those of us who are independent scientists on stage were not government officials. We were independent. And it's very clear in the terms of reference for SAGE that independent scientists are able to speak their mind, even when that may sometimes disagree with the policy decisions that are made. And I would say that was an important part of the transparency and the debate that happened during the last 3 years in the UK.
So with that difficulty that there is in having a single voice, do you think that causes problems for government's decision making? Because clearly scientists, just like everyone else, have different opinions and weigh up evidence differently.
I think it caused problems, yes. I think it is something that I hope the public inquiry will seek to address, because I think the opposite of that, which is that there is only one voice, which may become monolithic and is not transparent or is not perhaps willing to share with the public the differences of opinion, the uncertainty, and then through which policy is made, I think that would be worse. I think having debate and sharing with the public the uncertainty, the differences of opinions, etc., and then allowing government to do what government must do, which is ultimately to make policy decisions based on that range of different opinions, but also the humility of uncertainty.
I often think that really, as you say here, one of the difficulties is that science is not absolute, and there's uncertainty, as you say, and to some extent, one always has to make a leap in policy decisions from the best evidence that's available to make a decision. And that uncertainty is very difficult to handle.
Very difficult to handle, very difficult to communicate. And it's a tough, very tough job in government to make policy decisions which sort of have to be absolute, if you like, and with clarity on the basis of uncertain data and information, which will change. I mean, the pandemic is not a static thing. It changes over time and it can change very quickly over time. That's one of the great challenges. And yet you can't be making policy changes, you know, every day. So I think it's an extraordinarily difficult. I do think governments, not UK, every government, will have to reconsider how that is done within a government machinery, because I think we are likely to face more protracted, complex crisis situations in the future than perhaps we've historically done in the past, and which affect the whole of society. You know, the pandemic wasn't just a health issue. It was a societal issue, education, transport, borders, jobs, economy, and then, of course, geopolitics, what I previously described as the four circles of impact of a pandemic. And governments on the whole tend to think in vertical silos again, health in one bit, education in another, transport in another, geopolitics in another, borders in another, crossing multiple ministries. And I think one of the lessons for me of the pandemic is when something affects the whole of society, someone somewhere needs to bring it together to look horizontally across the impacts of everything rather than just one of the silos in isolation.
And of course, for those in science, having new evidence is something we relish, being able to change our mind because we have new information which challenges what we thought. But if, as you say, you're trying to make government policy in a rapidly changing field where new evidence might mean you need to change direction, politically that's a U-turn which is not allowed and becomes a political issue. So I think that's another thing which perhaps we need to do better at getting across, that as evidence emerges, we must change our view as time goes on.
Agree with that. I think maybe a better way of framing it, though, is to think, what is our strategic direction of travel in this, let's say, pandemic or in another crisis in the future? What are we desiring as our outcomes if we can achieve them? And then the individual decisions become tactical decisions, but they perhaps don't lose sight unless there are dramatic shifts in that strategic perspective. And the second thing is your comment there about understanding science and the uncertainty of it. I go back to my comment about Cheryl Tickle earlier, where she showed me the scientific interest of uncertainty. And I think that what we need to do a better job of is building that understanding of science, scientific methods, not in a crisis. I think you can't build things in a crisis. It's what you have before that makes the difference. And if there is a bedrock of trust before a crisis, that will serve you during the crisis to some degree. If there's a bedrock of mistrust in science, in institutions, perhaps misunderstanding of the scientific method and uncertainty, then that will be amplified and exaggerated in a crisis when there's a tension on. So I think this is not about building trust in a crisis. It's about building trust every Monday and Tuesday, and then using that trust in the best way possible in a crisis.
Well, Jeremy, you've given us a lot of homework to do with developing vaccines against different influenza strains and other pandemic strains, drugs that could treat those infections, also building trust in science in the meantime. So what do you do to relax between your busy life at WHO in Geneva?
I've always thought that all of us, whatever your job, whatever your professional and personal life, you have to have somewhere where you can go to and take a hat off or a coat off and be something different. We all need to protect ourselves to some degree. And so I find that space in playing cricket. I haven't started playing cricket in Geneva, but I've replaced it with walking around the lake or swimming in the lake or walking in the mountains. Whilst I'm in the UK, I play cricket in the summer and the rest of it. And I've discovered in the last year or two classical music, which I had no knowledge of before. But I find it's a space you can go to, listen to remarkable individuals doing live, and just almost take your coat and hat off and get into a different world. And I think protecting oneself in the hurly-burly and the pressure of everything that we all deal with, not you or me, or is really critical. Because if you don't build up the resilience in those sort of oases of calm, when you do have pressure on, as we all do, I'm not sure I would have the resilience to deal with that had I not built up some credit from cricket, walking in the mountains, swimming in the lake, or listening to music.
Well, I'm not sure that with English cricket that necessarily gives you a safe place at the moment. Jeremy Farrar, Chief Scientist at the World Health Organization, thank you for sharing some insights from your career and experiences of outbreaks and the recent coronavirus pandemic.
A pleasure, Andy, and thank you for all you and your colleagues do. You changed the world in 2020, and we should never forget that.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories, and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.